Thank you for inviting me to come down here and talk to you. And particularly, thanks very much for inviting me on Gay Pride Day. I hadn't realised it was Gay Pride Day, so I thought I'd come on the train. My plan was to go from Swindon to London, have a little snooze at 7 in the morning, and then from around 8:30 in the morning, I get my notes out and do all the editing that I normally do before I do a talk on the train. On the train, I was hijacked by 6 very big gay men. I was stuffed into a corner. The train was packed. Everyone was drinking champagne and singing some of the filthiest songs I've ever heard. The gay guys kept saying to me, look, we're really, really sorry. We think you're straight, but it's okay. I'm absolutely fine. They were making up songs. It was absolutely brilliant. There was a big group of gay women, and theirs was something like, hooray, hooray, we're off to Brighton today for a drink and a lunch with a lesbian bunch. Hooray, 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 hooray. Big crowds of people singing these songs. It's fab, isn't it? There's a song for everything. And then I thought, well, you know, the last time I was here, I was on stage with Desmond Dekker. And I shared a dressing room with him, and he was the king of ganja reggae. So I thought, well, today we'll be really tame compared to that, but it isn't at all. Anyway, we're here in one piece. We're having a few problems with the bits and pieces, but I hope we can get through this. I work as a music therapist at St. Michael Servell House in Oxford. Servell House is an adult hospice where we have a day service, where we have about 18 patients coming every day, and an inpatient unit where we have 18 beds. We also have a community service, 911 nurses, and who go and visit people in their homes. We also have a bereavement service too. So it's a big, comprehensive hospice service. We work with people who are ill, we work with their families, we work with their carers and their children. And my job there is music therapist. It's not really the job I imagined for myself sort of 10 years ago. 10 years ago I was a community musician working with young children with profound learning difficulties. So, and I was on this road of discovery for myself, really, beginning to realise that you can help people make music. People who don't have a voice, as we might recognise at all. People who just make tiny sounds. Making music and songs out of breathing and scratching and tapping. And I loved it. I really loved it. I still do a bit of that work in schools these days, helping schools to try and adopt a policy of singing, not speaking. We have whole days where we meet the buses at the front, and instead of going, oh, hello, John, how are you this morning? It's, hello, John, how are you today? And it's remarkable. It's amazing the difference it makes. I'm preaching to the person. But it really, I don't know if any of you have worked in special education, but singing in special education is just so crucial. But I ended up working in hospice, which, as I said, is something that I never really imagined that I would do, but I ended up there on a placement. And despite my initial fear, I actually found a lovely place. And while the context of working with people at the end of their lives is very different from working with people in music with handicap, with real profound disabilities, the context is really the same. And that is that music is actually an inherent human sense. Our hearing is fully formed in the womb at around 14 weeks. So our early development is this dance of a billion neurons all connecting and responding to sound and music. It's remarkable, isn't it? 14 weeks after conception. And they measured the inside of the womb at around 90 decibels. 90 dB, that's really, really loud. And so a lot of our very early development is accompanied by the sound of the inside of our mothers and her voice, but also lots of sounds from outside. You'll all be aware of the Mozart effect when they took a group of expectant mums and played Mozart music to them throughout the period, and then afterwards, about 3 days after the children were born, they were able to demonstrate that these children actually recognised this music. And so for a while, and actually in still some quarters, they say, the Mozart effect, play Mozart while you're pregnant, you'll get brighter kids. Where I trained as a music therapist in Bristol, they're a bit more basic down there, really. So they decided to do the same test with the East Enders team, and they got exactly the same results. It's interesting, isn't it? So maybe it's not so much about Mozart, who of course is genius, and who wouldn't want to be born to the clarinet quintet? But if you offer music that's moderately challenging, it fires off these neurons, and we start to learn, we start to respond, and we start to grow. And that's really exciting for working with young people who have a real disability, perhaps as a result of some anoxic event during birth. Because whenever you look into their eyes, it's worth remembering that their early musical development was probably the same as yours. And so their relationship with music is already deep and profound. And often people say, actually, music is the one way to reach these young people. But anyway, enough of that. I still do a little of that. I still find it very fascinating. But most of the work I do these days is, as I said, working at the end of life and end of bereavement. And what I'm going to do today is I'm going to introduce you to some of the people that I've worked with. I'm going to tell you a little bit about them. And I'm going to let you, hopefully, hear some of the amazing music that they've created. And we can have a chat about it. You can tell me what you think you're hearing. I'd be really interested to hear from you what. I've never had a chance to present to so many people who just teach singing. And of course, all of my work is about the human voice. Paul Theroux wrote that death is so painful to contemplate that it causes us to love life and value it with such passion that it may actually be the ultimate cause of all joy and all art. There's a thought, isn't it? I think what he's trying to say, not that I should paraphrase Paul Theroux, but I think what he's saying is actually this kind of shared existential fear that we have around dying, that we all share, regardless of where we're from and where we are in our journey, could well be the thing that motivates us to create art, music, in the first place. So maybe it's something about saying, I'm here, or I was here. Or maybe it's more than that. Maybe it's actually something about saying, I need to express something that there is nothing else for me to express it in this way. Anthropologists agree that music is our very first language. They argue about pretty well everything else. They argue about almost everything else, but the one thing they agree with is that we were probably singing to each other before we were talking to each other. And there's fantastic amounts of evidence to demonstrate that music has been a part of pretty well every culture that's been discovered. A world without song and music is completely unimaginable. So, there are all sorts of different ways that we can connect with it and become involved with it and use it to express ourselves. And the first person I'll introduce you to is a lady named Eileen. I met Eileen in a dementia care home. This building is on two floors, 32 people on each floor. On the ground floor, people with moderate dementia. Upstairs, people with profound dementia and Alzheimer's. They often refer to it as the wanderers, because there are lots of people just walking around, very confused and very lost. Here's an interesting thought for you as teachers of singing. We know that if you're working with people with Alzheimer's or dementia who haven't spoken for a long, long time, the one thing that you can connect them back to is song. It's clinically proven, it's a scientific fact, it's the last thing that goes. So why aren't all our dementia care homes really populated by people who can sing? The people that I work with in this particular place were all fabulous nurses, but they were all from the Philippines. They didn't really speak a great deal of English, and they had no chance of connecting with 80, 90-year-old people in some kind of musical way. If we know that music and singing is so important, and it's the last thing that goes, and that we have, that should we suffer from dementia without time, somebody comes up to us and sings our favourite aria or my favourite Beatles song, because that might actually give me a chance to reconnect with the people that I love, then then maybe we need to make it happen somehow. So that's your task. So I met Eileen on the top floor, and she was referred to me as a music therapist because she made a sound that went la, 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 and she didn't stop. She just kept making the sound. And the referral was, could you shut her up? Because she was driving the staff mad. But she was also annoying some of the other patients. And I thought, well, I'm not going to try and shut her up. And I'm going to start from the point of believing that Eileen is expressing something, or at least trying to express something, or else she wouldn't have the amount of determination and energy it takes for a 92-year-old woman who hasn't spoken ever since she's been in this place, no one's ever heard her talk, to go lap, lap, lap for hours on end. I suspect she was asking to be listened to. So I took her into her room. And really all I did was to just sit and listen to this la, 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 and then I just matched it with my own la, la, la. So in the end we just went la, la, la together. And eventually I just turned my la, la into la, 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 la. And I just shifted my voice from speaking into singing. And so did she. Immediately, she just followed into singing. I worked with her on 5 occasions. She went from singing very simple la, 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 to doing the most extraordinary performances. I think she sang several names. I can't be sure it sounded like names. I often wondered if it was the names of relatives or lost loved ones. I don't know. And there was no information there to be had. But she sang, and she was really determined to sing. The last time I saw her was the day that she died, and I went there and they said, no, you can't see Eileen, she's very poorly, and we think today that she's going to die. So I sneaked into her room because I wanted to say goodbye, and I sat with her, and I just gently sang her name, which is something that I've been doing throughout our sessions. Hello, Eileen, Eileen, just singing a little bit. And lo and behold, she sort of started to clear her throat and sing a little. She then performed what I've come to call as Eileen's swan song. So have a listen and see what you think we're listening to here. Yeah, a lot of my work with her was once we established a kind of a routine, I actually just sit. And there were just three very open, simple chords that I always played. And she just improvised melodically. And I always just tried to follow her. Possibly, but sometimes it felt like I was leading at the beginning, and I think I probably was. But she took over. That's about 4 minutes in, and I thought that la 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 was just about my cue for, okay, I've had enough. 40 minutes later, she's still singing. An hour passed by, she was still singing, and I had to go. I had no place to go. So I had to say goodbye to Eileen while she was still singing. And as I walked down to the corridor going to the lift, my abiding memory was that Eileen was still singing. Sri Lanka, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Was that the day that she died?
It was. That was the morning, and she died that night.
And they didn't want you to see her?
Well, they felt that it would be inappropriate, yeah, they were worried about it.
How did you feel that?
Because I don't really know. Stop asking such difficult questions. I think what's really interesting for me is working in dementia care and then working in hospice, is that we're dealing with exactly the same thing. But the attitude and the approach to working with people is very, very different.
I wonder if there's an embarrassment level, maybe from some members of staff, when they hear that sound, that there's a reaction maybe from some people, there's a slight embarrassment, which there should not be, of course.
For some people, they don't think that they're listening to singing, no. But I think the big thing is probably that in hospice, we're there to support people as they die. Dying is our business. Whereas in dementia care, at the point of someone dying, perhaps that it's more about doing that behind closed doors and without therapists buzzing around. So it's a very different approach. It's been very interesting for me to work in both establishments at the same time. Maybe furious, really angry, because I wanted the hospice ethos to seep into dementia care. Still do. And there's lots of brilliant people out there trying to make it happen. Mostly singers, mostly musicians. That's probably a little unfair on the artists and the activities coordinators, but it's mostly about singing. One of my colleagues has set up this wonderful group in Gloucestershire where she just gets volunteers, she gets them singing, gets them confident, they go in and work with the staff and get the staff singing, and all of a sudden, whole groups of people with dementia are actually communicating with each other for a while. It's fabulous. It's not rocket science, we know it. And it's cheap. If there's a pill, sorry, you've got me on one now. If there was a pill that you could give to everyone without times and dimension, instead of what you're going to do is just give this to this person once a day, and when they take it for at least an hour, they'll reconnect with people in the room, and if you bring their loved ones in, they'll do that with their loved ones. There are no side effects, and it costs about 35 quid an hour for 10 people. Then if we weren't giving it to everyone, the whole nation would be in uproar. Well, that's what we're talking about. It's nuts. Anyway. I'm going to introduce you to another person. This chap's name is David. I met David about a year ago in a day centre at Sowell House. David was very poorly, he had cancer. And the illness that affected, he had brain mets. He was very poorly. But I hadn't heard him talk, in fact. He was quite confused. He used to come to the day centre, and often the whole morning would be about moving biscuits around a plate, and he would take the whole morning just trying to sort out in what order to have his biscuit and his cup of tea. He was very isolated, and he was very difficult to help. And difficult for the other patients, because in this kind of place, there's a fabulous sense of community amongst the patients. They're the best healing that they get for each other. And they find it difficult to know what to do with David, really. And then one day I was in there, I took my guitar. This was the first time I'd done it with David in the room. And I was just murdering some songs from the 30s that I listened to. And we were all having a bit of sing-along. And then we were doing some gospel thing. I think it was with some, I can't remember. It's some gospel-y thing, very simple gospel-y thing. And David just stood up in his chair and his eyes were closed, and he just reached up to the sky and just stood there like this. And I thought, okay, that looks to me like a real invitation from David for me to go and perhaps do some work with him. So the following week, I got him over to the music room. I had this lovely music room, I'm very lucky. And I sat him down at the piano, and I thought, well, I'm just going to play, I'm a terrible pianist, I'm just going to play a couple of simple chords and see if that inspires David to kind of have that emotional, perhaps spiritual, experience that I thought I'd see in the day center. And actually what happened was something a bit different. He cleared his throat and at the sound of this most incredible improvised and song for his wife. So the whole routine went from this idea that I might offer him some kind of spiritual moment to actually a whole regime, a whole routine of exercise. But we'd go around the garden three times, he'd come sit at the piano, get good posture, sing these beautiful songs, just make them up as he went along. And then halfway through, we'd go around the garden one more time, back in, a bit more singing, and then finish around the garden twice, in for lunch.
I'm curious to know, and it probably sounds like a rather dark question actually, but are there certain keys that, I mean, would he, if you were doing that on quite a regular basis, there are certain keys that you would actually use for, or the same key that you would use each time, or would you, because I thought towards the end there, you sort of introduced something slightly different, and it seemed thrown in.
Yeah. That was me being a really bad music director. It's such a good question. What we're trying to do in our work is to be as transparent and almost invisible. It's all about the relationship with this person in the music. And so yeah, every now and again I can hear myself, some of the recordings, I can really hear myself getting in the way, singing some strange chord that is completely pointless because I know it. I think one of the things about recording our work is that and taking it to supervisors to go, why? But if that didn't ruin the whole experience for David, F, I think I always played an F with David, and he really liked that.
Did it have any impact on on what he was doing in between your sessions.
Yes. Yeah, what happened in the afternoon is I'd go over in the afternoon and we'd sometimes just say go over and assassinate Cole Porter. And in that, he would start to sing. And of course, it was joyful for the other patients.
Did he then start to speak, as you said?
Yes, he talked a lot. Yeah, he had perfectly good language. Yeah. He could really talk. And so he started to make friends in the docent. And more people were able to sit with him, particularly volunteers. Often volunteers, if they're not doing something and engaging with people and making something really good happen, volunteers can often feel, you know, failures. It's a difficult thing being a volunteer in this kind of environment. And so it was much easier for them. They could sit and David could talk. And they loved it when David would stand up and sing. David delivered a couple of solos for us. Amazing. And Margaret. Margaret was alive. I thought Margaret had died. But Margaret was alive and I met her.
How old was he?
David was in his 70s. I don't want to play an excerpt from someone else from the same day centre. This is a lady called Dorothy. And Dorothy was very similar. She was in her 80s, and Dorothy had breast cancer. But then she had a huge stroke and couldn't talk anymore. And when Dorothy tried to speak, she just went, away, 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 away. And the trouble is that she'd been coming to the day centre for some time, so lots of her friends had known her while she could talk. And again, it's this business of language gets removed and all of a sudden people begin to feel very isolated. Again, I was lucky because I looked over and just did one of these impromptu music sessions. I had a book and I was going through the book and seeing which songs I could vaguely play. And I started to sing a song called Side by Side. And lo and behold, Dorothy began to sing. And the minute she sang, she stopped, jumped out of the chair, burst into tears, then burst out laughing. Everyone else was in tears or laughing, because it was such one of those eureka moments for us all. But it was just wonderful, because she found her voice. All she'd sung is side by side. But what I discovered in working with her, because I went on to do quite a lot of work with her, was as long as I could keep Dorothy thinking that she was making music and singing, right brain, if it is right brain, there's a lot of evidence that suggests now that when we do it, it's whole brain. You know, it's an incredible evidence about music that's coming out of the moment. It suggests that there is nothing like it, but we know it's a framework for learning and expression and understanding and emotion. I don't know how it works, but as long as Dorothy believed she was singing, she could find the language. The other thing was that she would often like to tell me off. So she'd flirt with me, or I was a naughty boy, or a spurned lover, or a bad boy, and it was all part of our relationship. It was fun. But in the recording, you'll hear her singing, and then you'll hear her start finger wagging, and just listen. She loses all the words, and it just goes into, oh, wait, 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 again. It's really interesting. But this is the science that we have on our side. That's me being completely inept. I'm talking about having science on our side.
Yeah.
just a clear example of this business of if in your work at any time you're working with someone who's had a stroke and people are really struggling, or somebody in your family, I mean, it has to, you know, there's hardly a family that isn't touched by some of this stuff. That just by helping, placing whatever it is, this communication within the context of music, then there is always the potential for something like this to happen. Sorry.
I've noticed that in all cases that the voice is very strong, which is quite interesting. And the very first example, Eileen, the voice just got stronger and stronger and stronger as she went on. Mm. But there's this feeling that they're really using their bodies when they make these sounds.
Thank you, that's really interesting. Not being a singer, it's not something that perhaps I've thought about. What I have noticed is that there is an enormous determination. Most of the people that I work with, of course, will say, I don't do music, don't make me, and if you ask me to sing, I'm leaving. And that's really, you know, what I'm greeted with almost all of the people I work with. I work with very few people with any kind of musical background. But when people discover that within this context, what singing feels like and how it helps them, I think there's a huge determination to do something around it, to actually be committed to that.
Have you worked with anybody deaf? Because often old age goes with deafness.
I don't have any recordings of working with deaf people. But yes, I have worked with deaf people. I've done a lot of work with deaf youngsters who are profoundly disabled. And I use a thing called a resonance board, which is, I don't know if you've seen it in the schools that you might have been in, very simple piece of ply on a frame. And we lie down together on the board so that we pick up. You've heard of vibroacoustics. Mm-hmm. You know about vibroacoustics in your work, of course. So we lie down and then we can actually use the resonance. And I use microphones and put the speakers on the boards. And I've worked with the most profoundly deaf people where we made vocal sounds. And if their amount, if the glee and the joy is an indication of whether or not they're hearing it, I swear.
I think you've seen the elderly. Deafness is often a great handicap. Beethoven. I would say very musical people who and all that is inside them. I often feel extremely moved by.
I've done some work where I've tried to help with headphones, and I work with a chap at the moment who's almost completely deaf, who's doing some songwriting for his children. I might play one of his songs to him, and he can sing a tune. But we have to do it line by line, and I have to drop them in and out. It's an interesting question. I'm going to play you a song by a chap called Colin. This is a song written by Colin. A lot of the work that I do these days is actually helping people write songs. I was a songwriter. Part of my musical background was as a professional songwriter and a performer for a while. And I'd always known that songwriting was a really important way that I expressed myself, I think. Without being able to write how I felt in songs, I don't know really what I would have done. And so I was always fairly clear that I would take this into my work. And so now I do quite a lot of it. And as you can imagine, in hospice, a lot of people are trying to do work like life review. A lot of people want to create something for their own funeral, for their own rites of passage. And a lot of people want to leave important messages. Some people actually want to heal wounds that have been there for years and years, and they know this is the last chance. And actually offering them the opportunity to do it in music and song, it takes it away from being this business of sitting down with a blank sheet of paper and having to say it or write it. And I found in my work that as long as I keep things musical, then often people will work in a much more intuitive and spontaneous way. So a lot of people I work with just sit and play metal phone, and I'll just strum a guitar, and we'll just improvise, and often that will become the basic melody of the song, and I'll just take some of the simple melodic ideas and encourage them to develop them. And then as far as the words go, we don't paraphrase, we don't change anything, we just use the words exactly as they are, and I'll play a couple of examples of some of the things that that people have written. This is a song by a chap called Colin. Colin wrote four or five beautiful songs, including just a couple of weeks before he died, his granddaughter was born, Ella. And it's a lovely song for her, which he had a riff with his son. And he was able to deliver this song, post it through the letterbox. And his son listened to this lovely greeting song for his daughter, Colin's granddaughter. And it's a long story, and I've been there to 20 seconds. But as a result, there was a real healing wound. It was wonderful, a very simple song. But the song I'm going to play, just to convince you that I don't just deal in misery, is a song by Colin, the first song he wrote with me. And he said, I want to write a song about what it's like to have cancer. So I said, okay, where do you want to begin? He said, well, I'll begin with, I want it to be about the most consistent thing for me. And I said, what's that? He said, it's lunch. I could be at the hospital, I could be at home, I could be here. Everybody thinks I've got to have lunch, wherever you are. It's, well, Colin, how are you feeling? Dreadful, thank you. Oh, don't miss your lunch. And of course he's right. We are at the hospital, we're completely obsessed with making sure everyone has a really nice dinner. So this is Colin. This is Colin telling you what it's like to be suffering.
Okay. Take one. Here's a little intro.
Some days you do, some days you don't. Some days you will, some days you won't. But your lunch is always waiting just the same.
Sitting at the piano on the white notes. I do a lot of sitting down with people just playing the white notes of the piano. So some of the music comes from me in this. With some people that I work with, I write all the music. They write just the words. But with most people, there are elements of the music that they write. And with some people, they write the whole thing. This is very similar, actually. This is a chap called Casper. I worked with Casper for 10 months. Casper was from Denmark, and he was 32. His little daughter was 4 months old, and he fell over in the garden one Saturday afternoon. And pretty much that was it. He had a brain tumour. And I got to work with him for 7 months, and right up until the time that he died. And Casper used music in all sorts of different ways. He was obviously understandably shocked and incredibly angry, and who wouldn't be? And he wrote some very powerful songs and produced an album with the help of some of his friends in Denmark called Souls and Shadows. And with me, before he died, he started a thing called the Souls and Shadows Foundation, if you look that up on the internet. It exists to support the work of music therapists in end-of-life and bereavement care, and it's raised thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds. So it's a fantastic legacy. And Cass, well, obviously for Casper, the most awful thing was the fact that he thought that Legal was going to forget it. She wouldn't remember that. She would only be just over a year old when he died. And he thought that was profoundly sad. So he wrote her a lovely lullaby. This is very short. This is... Has worked incredibly well. I have about 25 examples, and I realise I've used about four. So I blame Gay Pride. I want you to hear this. This is the other extreme of the work. I currently work with a lady called Val, who's it was a concert pianist the other day, and she's very poorly, and she wants to leave music behind for all of her family. And when I talked to her about songwriting and composition, she said, "It's just not that easy. You just don't understand." I love the proposal. And so we had this kind of ongoing thing. But anyway, we've become great friends. She's wonderful. We've actually done a couple of concerts together. I go out and I perform these songs, believe it or not, in concerts, in art centres and little theatres. And for the patient that I'm working with, who's still with us, they'll often come and perform with me. It's just amazing. It's fantastic. I'll just stand there and cry, really. It's wonderful. Anyway, I want you to hear a bit of Val. This is Sarah. So Val, instead of composing, she lifts bits from all her favourite composers, so you'll love it. See how many you recognise. Often people hear truth in themselves for the very first time. You know, how many times have you really, really sat and listened to someone and they said, "Oh my God, I didn't realise I actually felt that." And so it's that business of listening. And as musicians, of course, you know, we should be and can be the best at that. It's about being a collaborator, helping people create work. It's being an accompanist and a co-writer. It's about all sorts of things. But ultimately, I think it's an amazing privilege. Regardless of how difficult it feels sometimes, and it does feel difficult sometimes, I order something in that I probably can't find now. Yeah, the idea that you can, the expectation that we can be immersed in suffering and loss daily and not be touched by it is as unrealistic as expecting to be able to walk through water without getting wet. That's really true. And so the other part of our job really is being mindful of this and taking care of it. Almost all of the people, the new people I've met in my life in the last 8 years now, have died. And it's what you do with that. The difficulty for us, for all of us, is that we're so immersed in music. Robert Wycross, who's one of the godfathers of music therapy, and I've done a few things with him, and he always introduces me by saying, he's the guy with the easiest job in palliative care, but the hardest job. And it's the easiest job because with music, you get into people and you meet people at extraordinary places very, very quickly. But the difficulty is with music, it's often hard to get back out again. It's just glory. And in your own work, you know, I guess there are times when you develop relationships with students, with people, and you have those experiences. But ultimately, our work is about relationship. You know, there is no real work without relationship. It's that relationship and that trust that actually makes all the difference. And in my work, really, it's about helping people to create whatever it is that they need to create. Irving Allen, the fantastic psychotherapist from the States, when he was retiring, he wrote to all his big clients and said, look, I guess, you know I did amazing things to you guys. Why don't you write to me now I'm retiring and tell me just how fantastic I was? And expecting that they'll write back, say, oh my God, you know, imagine my family through your young year insights, you know, blah, 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 blah. And none of it came. He said, but what did come through is a triple of little letters that all said pretty much the same thing. And that was, everything changed for me when you said, okay, what shall we do? I think in my work, that's kind of my boss. Sitting in the center, okay, what would you like to do? And what's important? What do you need to do? I'm going to leave you with one final piece of music. This is really a very profound example of what I find it famous. This is a very profound example of the power of song and the voice. This is a little sad, but the story has something of an element of joy to it. This is the story of Yibi, and Yibi was from Africa. He was adopted by parents in Africa and brought back to Britain. And he was HIV positive, and they knew that, and they adopted him. When he was 13, 14 years old, Yibi developed full-blown AIDS, and he was dying. And his parents, having taken this risk, they knew they were taking this risk, but they were also still very, very shocked and very angry and quite bitter. And what Yibi wanted to do was to tell them not to be bitter. That was really important. 14-year-old boy who was dying. The most important thing is they know that they can carry on, and it's a beautiful world, and that they can carry on. And so he wrote them a song, a tiny little song, and this is the recording of him singing the song to his parents, and it's the only time he sang it. It's called Beautiful Mummy. This is the work of a colleague of mine, Rachel Astor, in East London. Sunday morning, and hundreds of people got in touch. and ask for copies of that. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's such a sad thing. And as a result of that, thousands of people have been in touch and raised thousands and thousands of pounds. And for them, Yibi's legacy is this beautiful little song that inspires them to look at the world through slightly different eyes, through Yibi's eyes, and to carry on. I'm going to leave you with a poem because that's the kind of, I love poems. And this is about our work, all of our work. This is about the places that we go to. It's called The Gap Between. What did they do? The singers, the tale writers, the dancers, the painters, the shapers and the makers. They go there with empty hands into the gap between. And they come back with things in their hands. They go silent and come back with words, with tunes. They go into confusion and come back with patterns. They go limping and weeping, ugly and frightened, and come back with the wings of a red hawk and the eye of a mountain lion. That's where they live, where they get the breath. They're in the empty place, in the gap between. Thank you for listening.